Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. This is the second episode of the monthly Respiratory Health Series from the American Lung Association and HCP Live. In case you missed it, our debut episode last month featured HIV/AIDS research pioneer and world-renowned virologist, Dr. David Ho, who led us through some of the clinical and public health challenges presented by COVID-19. If you missed it, be sure to tune in after listening to today's episode. For now, let's introduce today's topic and guest. It is September 2020. Coronavirus has been a pandemic for 6 months, and there is still a distinct layer of uncertainty set forth by the virus and its ongoing global impact. Definite resolutions, including vaccines, informed school and business reopening plans, and lifted social distancing mandates, remain hindered by the great unknowns of COVID-19 with its periodic surges and hotspots. The U.S. has finally achieved a drop in daily new cases and mortality, but true breakthroughs still await. Science, at its truest, is investigative, deliberate, and methodical. And as Dr. Ho recently told us, it's science that will deliver the solutions to COVID-19. This past May, Dr. Ankit Bharat was an exception to that rule. In a moment of learning as you go, the chief of thoracic surgery and surgical director of the Northwestern Medicine Lung Transplant Program led an unprecedented procedure, a double lung transplant of a young woman dying from COVID-19. Dr. Bharat joins us for a discussion on the COVID-19 discoveries made in his first and following patients' double lung transplants, how the prioritization of lung transplantation has and has not been influenced by the pandemic, and what his team's work meant for the immediate advancement of COVID-19 care in the critically afflicted patients. We hope you enjoy. So I'm really pleased that you took the time today, Dr. Ankit Bharat, to talk to us at the American Lung Association. We know you're very busy, especially doing the surgeries that you've been doing. But I know our audience is very excited to start hearing about your transplant experience. But before we jumped into that, I want to just get an opportunity to kind of fill me in on how you got to where you are, what made you decide to do surgery, transplant, and just fill us in on that a little bit, if you could.
Sure. So I joined Northwestern about 7 years ago. I came from St. Louis. Washington University actually is one of the meccas for lung transplant. Dr. Alec Patterson, who's one of the pioneers in the field, in fact, did the first successful double lung transplant in the world, was one of my mentors there, and he was the head of cardiothoracic surgery. So I was fortunate to be, you know, mentored by him. So I came to Northwestern about 7 years ago as the director of the future lung transplant program. We didn't have it at that point. So we successfully, you know, launched that program, performed the first transplant on Independence Day 2014, actually. And, we've been, growing, and our mission has been to take on not just the straightforward situations and conditions, but also the more complex, you know, diseases and states that put patients at harm and potentially may not be offered at other centers. So, you know, we, you know, routinely treat patients with all sorts of end-stage lung diseases, both standard as well as sort of the rare conditions. We see patients both from the local region, nationally, as well as internationally. So when the COVID started, you know, we've been involved with these patients right from the start because, you know, certainly this virus affects the lungs predominantly, and you know, the thoracic surgery team and the pulmonary division have been working very closely to care for these patients, performing, you know, the routine management, but also, you know, when they need surgeries and procedures and so forth. So, you know, ever since, we saw the first patient, we were anticipating that we are going to have, you know, some patients who, despite the best medical treatment, end up in a situation where their lungs are completely damaged and they will be stuck on the ventilator and having complications after complications. So we had actually toyed with the idea of, you know, potentially exploring lung transplant as a treatment option for those patients who fail the medical treatment and then have no other option. So we had been exploring this and preparing, our program, putting procedures and policies to the best of our of knowledge to treat these patients if they need it. So that was sort of the brief background of how we got to this point.
And that actually leads into one of my questions. We're going to be transplanting a post-infectious person, especially somebody with COVID-19. Must have took a little thought on your team's part. How do you go about it? Is it something, were there any ethical issues that came up during the course of all that discussion?
Yes, you know, that it was a very complex decision, as you can imagine. You know, one of the big changes or the changes in the paradigm that this whole transplant brought was offering lung transplant for an infectious disease, as you pointed out. So, you know, the way we looked at it is the following. You know, we're not trying to treat the virus. We are trying to treat the complication that resulted from the virus leading to end-stage lung disease. And, you know, as far as we were concerned, we believe that lung transplant is a treatment for end-stage lung disease, regardless of the cause. Now, the important thing for us to consider and the big unknown was the host cleared the virus. How can we say that for sure? And, you know, if you transplant someone and immunosuppress them, can the virus come back? And that was the biggest unknown that we faced. And we had to, that's why, you know, go through pretty rigorous testing to ensure that these patients, you know, cleared the virus. And we were actually fortunate in the sense, medically fortunate, that we had cared for a lot of these patients. So we understood the natural course of, you know, how these patients go through, how long they take to clear the virus and so forth. And in fact, we had implemented a warm autopsy program, which is quite unique in the region and nationally also. And in that program, you know, within 1 hour of patient's death from COVID, a team would go and perform the autopsy study, obviously with the family's consent, to understand, you know, what's going on. And we were actually performing bronchoscopies in these patients from the start, looking at the clearance of virus and all that. So that all of those initial studies helped us understand that. The ethical concerns that came about were, you know, this was at the height of pandemic, and there were so many patients, resources were strained. You know, we didn't have enough vans, we didn't have, you know, enough ECMO machines to go, and the patients were just coming in like, you know, loads of patients every day. So it was easy to say, you know, once patients are not getting better in 3 to 4 weeks and they have complications after complications, should we be talking about redirecting goals of care and stuff like that? And then using those resources for other patients who are relatively early in the course. So those were some of the debates, you know, how far do you go to reallocate those resources on an individual who's already so far into the disease process, not knowing whether it's going to work or not. And then certainly, you know, there were questions about, you know, the demand and supply when it comes to lung transplant. You have only a limited number of organs and you're doing it on a patient who may or may not survive, while there are a lot of other patients who are waiting for the transplant. So how do you kind of reconcile those things? So we had to kind of think through a lot of those things. And then the final thing, which was also quite important, was the risk to the healthcare providers, you know, without really knowing with 100% certainty, because, you know, the tests are, you know, were changing almost on a weekly basis. New tests were coming up, new probes are coming up, so forth. So, you know, are we, you know, putting the healthcare providers at any risk by taking such a big task? So those are some of the, you know, main dilemmas, I would say, that we faced.
Do you think your experience with this will help restructure the lung allocation scores, so to speak, as far as how people are placed in categories to get the scarce donor lungs?
Yeah, you know, I think, first of all, I personally certainly recognize that there is a demand and supply gap. But I think that it's not a problem that we cannot overcome. Only 15%, if you look at the national rates, only 15% of all the lungs, you know, coming from all the donors, you know, they get utilized. So we have a huge opportunity to understand donor management and improve the utilization of those lungs. See, last year, you know, U.S. in the whole country, you know, only about 2,700 lung transplants were performed, and there were way more donors than that. And even if you look at a 10% mortality, so if let's say 3,000 patients need lung transplant and only 27 are getting the transplant, you know, there is, the gap is actually there, it's there, but that gap can absolutely be overcome by the amount of donors we have and if we focused our efforts towards that. So I don't personally think that that's a challenge we cannot overcome. We are already expanding our, you know, the donor pool to hepatitis C donors. Previously, no one was taking them, but now with the treatment for hepatitis C, we can, you know, use those lungs. We have also implemented ex vivo lung perfusion program. So with that program, we can take those, you know, quote unquote, marginal lung that may not be suitable for transplant when they get offered it initially. So we can take those lungs out of the human body, put it on an ex vivo circuit and repair them. And with that, you know, over 50% of those lungs can be utilized. So by using a lot of those, you know, strategy, we can expand those pools and help, you know, these other individuals who are in the need. As far as your question about reallocation, I think these patients, given how sick they are, they already get a pretty high score, the lung allocation score, the LAS. So typically their scores are above 80. The highest it can go is about 100. But if you're above 80, you're pretty much at the top of the list in that region. So the lung allocation system is really designed to understand the severity of the disease rather than the indication of. Now, certainly the diagnosis code really plays a role in how much points you get. And I certainly hope that, you know, with the success that we've had and other centers, you know, in the East Coast and West Coast, similarly performing these transplants and successfully getting these patients through, I hope that UNOS and OPTN, you know, includes COVID-19 as a diagnosis code in the registration of these recipients.
I know you had done the first double lung transplant in COVID-19 in this country, and I believe you've done a second one as well. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. We've done two so far, yeah. And we are evaluating a number of other patients who've been, you know, flown over to Northwestern for that purpose. So we are actively exploring a number of other recipients who are in the same situation. Weeks and months into the COVID, bound to the ECMO machine, bound to the ventilator with a number of complications, but they're otherwise, you know, young, healthy, and had no underlying condition, and they would have no other option but to die at this point without the transplant.
I was able to see a couple articles about the patients you transplanted who were doing quite well, last I heard, which is great for them. Was there anything particular about those cases you remember back thinking when you first met these patients? What might have been gone through your mind about, is this going to be the first one?
Yeah, so, you know, first patient was going to be an individual way back in April. So we were exploring, he was also young and quite sick. And as we were kind of working up for transplant, he developed a major complication with multi-organ failure and he expired, unfortunately. And that's what we realized, you know, these patients, once they get beyond 4 to 6 weeks on the ventilator, they can suddenly develop major complication, you know, complication that we would not expect. And they suddenly crash and then they expire. So actually that patient was going to be our first patient way back in April, but it ended up being the patient that we transplanted. And, you know, she was in the same situation, but in her case, you know, she was young, she was 28 years old. And how do you let someone like her die? And, you know, and her family and, you know, the caregivers that put her pictures in her room and, you know, you see how kind, you know, her pictures with her dog, her family, or other sisters, and you see her face, you know, and it, you can just help feel real sad for that patient. So we knew that we have to do everything to save her. And, you know, she did everything right in her life. She was staying home, she was following all the precautions, and unfortunately got the virus and very quickly, you know, got to the states that she was had no other option. The second patient was very similar. So after we did the first one, you know, we started getting calls, and this patient was from a healthcare system within our region. And this patient was on ECMO for when we got a call for about 90 days and the lungs are completely destroyed. There was, you know, if you saw the x-ray, you would think that someone had taken both the lungs out and filled both chest cavities with water or blood. There was not any region in the chest that had any air in it. So, you know, I actually went to that hospital that had referred because it was within the region, and we talked to family and they wanted to do everything for him. So we transferred him over and then we were able to list him and get him transplanted within, I think, 3 days of listing. So he's doing great too. He's also discharged, breathing normally, you know, no oxygen. He's getting stronger every day, and I'm confident he'll have a pretty good outlook ahead of him.
From the way you're describing it, it sounds like these transplants were just different from an anatomic and physiologic standpoint as compared to a COPD or pulmonary fibrosis transplant. Is that correct?
That's very correct, yeah. So, you know, there are a number of challenges that we faced in these patients. See, patients who have end-stage lung disease, right, they are pretty deconditioned and pretty sick to begin with. Now, we recognize that lungs have the gas exchange function, but, you know, sometimes we forget that the lungs are the gatekeepers for the body. You know, lungs are the only organs that are directly exposed to the outside air. So, you know, they have a lot of immune regulation function. They have, you know, temperature regulation. Your hydration status gets regulated. The host's ability to fight infections is dependent on the lungs. So there are a lot of biological functions that all of us, require our lungs to perform. So when patients get, end-stage lung disease, a lot of those functions get lost, and it impacts every system in the body. So these patients, even an emphysema patient or cystic fibrosis patient, you know, they're quite sick to begin with. But at least, you know, in the normal transplants, for the majority of the patients, we get these patients from home. We are able to get them to a pulmonary rehab. We are able to, you know, keep them as strong as possible. Now, in the COVID patients, you know, since we are considering transplant as a last resort, these patients have been in the ICU, sedated, immobilized, paralyzed with multiple complications throughout their course. So not only do they have the normal problems that end-stage lung disease patients have, in addition to that, they've sustained a number of additional complications. So that makes them relatively high risk to go through, you know, lung transplant. So that's one aspect of it. The second thing is double lung transplant is generally considered the most medically complex procedure that can be performed. So you take, you know, critically ill patient and you're taking them through a very complex medical procedure. And the other thing that makes it quite complex is that there is a very short window that these lungs like to be outside the human body. So you have to take these lungs out and implant them within 6 hours. So, you know, that includes taking it out of a donor body, you know, packaging them, coming to that local airport, because most of these lungs come from outside the state or the city, flying to Midway Airport in Chicago, taking, you know, the ambulance to Northwestern, taking old lungs out, putting new lungs in, all has to be done within 6 hours. So in COVID lungs, you know, the damage is so bad that the normal anatomic planes are completely destroyed. The lungs get completely destroyed, and there's so much inflammation that, the lung tissue, what's left of it, is completely plastered to the structures around it, to the heart, to, you know, the diaphragm. So that makes it very complex to get all of that out safely. And then any misstep potentially can lead to catastrophic bleeding, and that could be really bad. And the other thing is, you know, when the lungs have failed in these patients, that's what we've observed, you know, that gets them to develop secondary heart failure and secondary failure of the liver and all that because of afterload problems. So these patients intraoperatively are quite unstable, and you have to get them through. And then immediately post-op, you know, their recovery, because they are so deconditioned, their recovery is much more intensive. It involves a lot of immunological challenges because, you know, these patients have had throughout their course, you know, blood transfusions, being on ECMO and on the ventilator. Most of them have had convalescent plasma, which gives them a huge antibody load, and that can potentially make them susceptible to rejection and so forth. In fact, the first two patients, we were able to pick that up and treat them successfully for rejection. We observed that. So it's very different, I would say. But having said that, I also, having gone through this process, I can say with certainty that in the experienced centers and the experienced hands, you know, this can be done successfully with excellent outcomes.
Sounds like many of the transplants you do come from patients with long-term chronic illness. They come in from rehab programs and things, but with the increased use of ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, you're having more patients who are using that as a bridge to transplant, and that certainly carries with it more likelihood of complications in your mind?
Yeah, so, you know, ECMO has certainly helped, you know, bridge these patients to lung transplant, no doubt about that. You know, the mortality, you know, of patients who are waiting on transplant or who used to wait on transplant, you know, has gone down. At least we've seen it programmatically and regionally we are seeing that, so certainly. But then what ECMO has also done has allowed patients with other indications who may not have even made it to the consideration of transplant and evaluation to get to that point. So my view on ECMO as a bridge to transplant is the following. I don't think ECMO per se leads to complications. You know, patients who require ECMO prior to transplantation, they are much sicker to begin with. So naturally, you know, their post-transplant outcome is not as good as someone who comes from a rehab as an outpatient. So it's not that the ECMO is causing complications, it's just that those patients are sick to begin with. But having said that, I think that in the right patient, you know, even the patients who are on ECMO, we can safely do this with really good long-term outcome, no doubt.
So I guess between some ECMO being used to bridge the gap up, more and more treatments and successful treatment of COPD, pulmonary fibrosis, it sounds like there's going to be more and more of a need for the transplants. What do you see as far as the future of the transplant centers, transplant surgeons? Where are we from a medical standpoint with manpower and resources for transplants in general? You're obviously at a center that is top of the field. What do you see around the country?
You know, I think it's growing. Lung transplant is a growing field. I also think when we talk about solid organ transplants, lung transplants are the most recent addition. You know, they were 1986, first double lung transplant, and the field really didn't take off until, I would say, early 1990s. So compared to kidneys and hearts and, you know, liver transplant, which has been going on for over 50 years. So if you look at internationally, you know, the number of transplants being done across the globe is slowly growing. And that is due to the fact that our intra-op and post-op management is getting better and better. If you looked at, you know, the outcomes 10 years ago, you know, the intra-op mortality could approach 5 and with some reports up to 10%, meaning, you know, 5-10% of the patient may not make it out of the operating room, but now it should be 0. Even the 30-day survival is approaching close to 100%. So there has been a pretty dramatic improvement in our intra-op management and then the post-op management with the understanding of immunological challenges and so forth. We are getting better and better. And because of that, there is a broadening of indications for end-stage lung disease to be considered for transplant. You know, historically, pulmonary fibrosis, emphysema, and cystic fibrosis were the three big indications, but now it's really grown dramatically. You know, sarcoidosis, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, pulmonary hypertension, retransplants, scleroderma, connective tissue disorders leading to lung problems, they all have been accepted as a valid indication. And these are just a few that I've listed. I mean, I mentioned there's a huge long list, and now COVID. So from the personnel standpoint, I think, I mean, it certainly is a resource-intensive, treatment. It requires a very big team, both medically, surgically, and then the support staff, financial clearance, psychosocial support, you know, pharmacy, dietitian, a number of other people. So it's a intensive program, but I think in the right setting, you know, it can really be impactful for our patients. And I think, you know, payers and Medicare, they're all recognizing this and they support that.
Not only are we at the American Lung Association committed to discussing the most relevant COVID-19 information as it's happening, but as the trusted champion of lung health, we are invested in providing public health education and advocacy to all, especially socially disadvantaged communities and communities of color, to strive for health equity during this current pandemic and protect it against future threats from other respiratory viruses. And had patients with COPD with volume reduction techniques, again, as another bridge to maybe getting them to transplant. You see that as well?
Yeah. So actually, lung volume reduction surgery has also evolved quite a bit. A couple of years ago, we were the first in the country to pioneer robotic lung volume reduction surgery, and we've actually now trained a number of other centers to successfully perform that. You know, this was actually showcased in Times Square 2 years ago, and that has really transformed our ability to treat these patients with emphysema. So, you know, historically, with the conventional approaches, the length of stay with lung volume reduction surgery would be 2 to 3 weeks, but now it's 2 or 3 days, and they have a pretty dramatic improvement. Now, the lung volume reduction surgery, I will say that it's helpful in a very small group of patients. You know, we're talking about only emphysema, but even within emphysema, a small subset of patients that meet very strict criteria. And in those patients, it does work. So what I have observed is that lung volume reduction surgery has certainly helped a number of patients. It can actually eliminate the need for transplant in some individuals, but it can certainly delay the need for lung transplant in almost every patient who is going through the lung volume reduction surgery robotically. This has also coupled with bronchoscopic lung volume reduction programs, and that has also helped the patients who may not meet the criteria for the robotic lung volume reduction surgery. Having said that, I don't think overall the volume of patients who are going through this is going to be significant enough to alter the numbers of lung transplants substantially. Because, you know, emphysema in general gets a low priority in the lung allocation score. And we are seeing that, you know, nationally, the number of emphysema patients getting lung transplant is becoming less and less because other indications that, as I said, have grown, and then there is a much more priority based on the LAS score on those individuals.
Do the patients with COPD tend to have a less likely good outcome? Is that one of the reasons they don't get transplanted as often? Or?
It's a great question, but it's a difficult question to answer, and I'll tell you why. See, emphysema patients are the easiest transplants to perform, technically, and they, you know, post-transplant, they just fly through because it's a quick, we generally say there's nothing as an easy double lung transplant, but of all the double lung transplants, you know, emphysema patients are the easiest ones to do. What has happened was, you know, when the lung allocation started, the way the lungs were allocated was based on the duration of the wait time. So if a patient waited long enough, they would get the lung over other patients who didn't wait enough. But then there was this change in the lung allocation system that factored in the diagnosis code. And they recognized that patients who have emphysema can potentially wait longer, and their waitlist mortality tends to be lower, unlike patients who have pulmonary fibrosis, interstitial lung disease, and some other indications. So what happens is, you know, when we list patients for transplant, the OPT and UNOS, based on their criteria, the emphysema patients get really low scores. So it's not uncommon for most of the emphysema patients to get a score between 30 and 40, which is quite low compared to patients who have cystic fibrosis, ILD, and all that. They automatically jump to 45 and above. I'm just giving you arbitrary numbers, but just to illustrate the point that the scoring system, the way it's calculated, puts emphysema patients much lower. So as the lungs are coming in, you know, they get allocated to the patients who have the higher score with those other diseases. And that is one of the reasons why the transplant indications are moving away from emphysema. Having said that, we certainly still do emphysema patients, but the relative proportion has gone down.
Have you seen much of a change in the post-op management as far as the drugs are now available to help with the suppression of rejection?
We have much more data when it comes to immunosuppression and have many more options when patients have rejections and, you know, and chronic rejection and so forth. But I absolutely think that this is one area that has lagged quite a bit, especially in the context of lung transplant. We are still using somewhat conventional immunosuppression with things like tacrolimus, CellCept, and steroids. And so, you know, we have a pretty large NIH-funded program, and we are exploring novel agents in our research program as well. But I think that's an area that really needs to be looked at very quickly because there is an opportunity to really make a big difference in post-lung transplant survival.
So you mentioned, sounds like you're still very actively involved in some research opportunities there at Northwestern. I just wanted to bring up the fact and thank you that I think a few years ago you did some research for the American Lung Association. You did your article on carbon dioxide and effects on the airway. You want to just chat about that for a minute?
You know, I tell you, ALA was extremely helpful. So, you know, I was a junior investigator at that point. And, you know, junior investigators, you know, it's like starting any company. You know, no one wants to fund you when you're the first one or when it's your first project. You know, if you've had multiple R01s and all that, then you become more credible. So I feel like ALA really provided me an opportunity. It was a very important, funding that I received from ALA that really helped me continue my research. And today, you know, I have multiple, you know, R01 grants from NIH and all that. But really that, you know, the grant that I got from ALA within the first year of my faculty really helped me tremendously. And the project specifically was directed towards understanding the role of carbon dioxide in lung healing. And we had discovered that, you know, after lung cancer surgery, you know, a number of patients demonstrate delayed wound healing. So let me just simplify that a little bit. So if, let's say, an individual had a cancer of the upper lobe of the right lung, hypothetically. So in order to resect that, you know, you have to take the upper lobe out and separate it from the middle lobe and the lower lobe. So there is a raw surface that's left on the remaining lung. And some individuals can develop prolonged air leaks or bronchopleural fistulas, as we call it, for reasons that are unclear. So we had discovered that carbon dioxide is detrimental to wound healing. And in fact, you know, based on measurements of carbon dioxide around the lungs, so all these patients who have lung cancer surgery, they have a chest tube. So we actually analyzed carbon dioxide around the lungs through the chest tube, and we found that, you know, every 1% increase in carbon dioxide delays your wound healing by over 8 hours. And by modifying that carbon dioxide milieu, you can accelerate the lung healing. And then that observation then, which was supported by the ALA, then led to a much bigger project where we did a basic science, you know, program looking at, you know, using both mouse models and cell culture models to understand the molecular pathways, you know, through which carbon dioxide alters the milieu. And briefly, what we found was carbon dioxide, through unique cell signaling pathways, it impairs the ability of the cells to migrate towards each other and seal the injury defect. So the papers have been published now. In fact, you know, based on that work, you know, Northwestern had actually filed a patent to develop a new chest drainage system, which hopefully will be impactful in care of these patients in the imminent future.
Well, I want to thank you for those comments. I mean, this was not pre-scripted, but you pretty much gave a mission moment there that I'm sure our board of directors would like to hear, because we often say that some of the money that ALA puts into research really makes a difference in people's careers and leads them to do bigger and better things. And certainly doing the transplants that you have been, let alone the other research, is something ALA is very proud about. So you may be hearing from us more about doing that mission moment at some point. Before we move on to anything else about the transplant, anything else you want to mention that we hadn't talked about, challenges?
You know, I think, you know, my main thought process is, you know, in lung transplant, I think, you know, we just need to innovate. I feel like, you know, there's so much we don't know about lungs and, you know, the biology of it, both before and after transplant. So unless we kind of push the envelope and we put, there's so many patients globally, you look at the World Health Organization data, you know, the burden of disease when it comes to respiratory illnesses, right, is more than anything else in the next two or three put together. You know, we talk about cancer and cardiovascular, which is very, very important, no doubt. But the respiratory illnesses are so important. And a lot of this has to do with lung failure. So I by no means want to say that lung cancer and a lot of other not important, but the lung damage, lung injury, and lung failure has such a heavy impact on global mortality, and I feel like it's highly under-recognized. ARDS is another thing. ARDS, whether it's from COVID or influenza, you know, we routinely see patients who every fall and winter in Chicago, we see these young individuals, they're stuck in the same situation with ARDS and fibroproliferative ARDS, and they ultimately die. So I think we need to continue to focus on that. And whether it's lung transplant, whether it's understanding lung injury and repair, I think it's an important, it should be an important part of the mission for us, I think.
Well, that's a great message. I wanted to open up to Kevin or Stacy, if they had additional questions maybe they wanted to ask.
Yeah, Dr. Barat, something that has really stood out to me in my role of covering the pandemic has been the very sudden, pronounced, and sometimes comprehensive collaboration, these networks of research, the sharing of information, especially at the very immediate response to the virus's spread. You know, we were learning from Italy, from China, at the same time that we were first seeing cases and becoming impacted ourselves. And I can't help but imagine your work has especially entered that ether of discussion of it being another thing that's possible and even being something that helps us better understand the pathology of this thing a little bit better. Could you expand a little bit more on what that response looked like? In what ways did it come back to you after this huge success?
You know, when we first started to see these patients, I'll tell you, we take great pride in believing that we can handle most of the, if not all, the complex respiratory illnesses. But when this virus, you know, when we started to see COVID-19 cases, it was very puzzling, I tell you. I mean, it was just not something we had seen before. You know, the way the patients were, behaving was very unpredictable. They did not follow the standard, you know, medical management. And we were really struggling to understand. And the other problem that we were facing was, you know, the conflict in the published data, even in some of the top journals. You know, you see, you know, one journal, and I don't want to name any one, but one journal saying one thing, the other one conflicting it. And, you know, there was so much data that was being published, and it was just very hard to see through that. People were also looking at, their personal, opinions or experiences with other illnesses and trying to apply that. And they were, you know, strongly advocating, their experiences as the standard of care. And that also was conflicting, you know, whether it was Italy or China, you know, they're all saying different things. So it was very hard, you know, to really understand. And we talk about practicing evidence-based medicine and so forth, but there was no evidence. This is a new disease and you had to innovate. So it was a tough time, I'll tell you. So what we started to do was put in our efforts to understand as best as we could the biology of this disease and so forth. And one of the, the important things that we did that really helped us understand some of this was to perform, and we were fortunate that we had enough PPEs and all of that, so we could actually go and take care of these patients. We were doing lots of bronchoscopies, biopsies, and all that helped us guide the care. And with that, you know, and our paper is published already, you know, even in patients who get intubated with severe COVID-induced ARDS, our mortality is less than 15%, 1-5. If you look at, most of the published data, you know, early data showed an 80% plus mortality. And even in the most recent article that showed remdesivir, trial and dexamethasone trial, they showed the control arm a mortality of about 40%, which gets reduced to 25% with the treatment. So I think, you know, some of our early interventions helped us, you know, care for these patients and learn a lot, whether it was secondary bacterial infections leading it, for development of lung fibrosis and trying to intervene on that. So that kind of helped us. And we tried to then start to work with the local centers and our collaborators regionally and nationally to gain insights from them and share our insights with them. And I think that was helpful. We learned a lot. One of the big areas of debate, and I'll give you one small example, was bronchoscopies. You know, a lot of centers said bronchoscopy should not be done. And we started initially, you know, to do them, and we found that a lot of these patients actually were plugging their airways because no one wanted to clear their airways. Respiratory therapists were somewhat hesitant in going there because, you know, no one knew what the virus could do to you. So these airways were getting filled with inflammatory exudate and airways getting plugged. So we were able to clean a lot of that out and understand, you know, what that makeup was and treat those patients. And then at the same time, we implemented this warm autopsy program where, you know, we were able to get into the chest, take biopsies of the lung within an hour of patient's death and understand what changes at the single cell level these patients were experiencing and how can we better understand the biology and try to put them to the path for treatment. After the transplant, you know, it's been a great, collaboration. I think people have been very open. You know, we started discussing transplant in an international forum from people come from Europe, US, you know, China, everywhere. You know, we started to put our minds together. And after we did the transplant, you know, Florida has done a transplant. I think Cleveland Clinic has done. A number of other states are exploring that. And they have reached out to us to learn from our experience and to help them better take care of those transplant patients. So I think there is a growing recognition of transplant as a potential option for patients who fail medical therapy. And I think that's an important recognition because I don't think that even when the vaccine comes up, it'll be 100% effective. And even with the best medical treatment, it's going to be 100%. There is no therapy that in the contemporary medicine that is 100% effective. So in, despite the preventative measure, despite the best medical treatment, we are going to see some patients, you know, who will progress to this situation. And we have to use both medical and surgical innovation, you know, to serve our community from this pandemic.
Anything else you'd like to add? You've taught me a lot. This has been very informative. We look forward to some of the research coming out of your program. I'm sure it will be published and vetted the way it will be because of your background.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, we have actually two papers in the final stages. One is in New England Journal of Medicine. Other one is in Nature. Hopefully it will come out in the next 2-3 weeks. And we've identified some unique changes, which I think is going to be a unique pathobiology in the pandemic, which actually hopefully is not just restricted to COVID. It just shows us some novel pathways. So hopefully this will be out in the next 4 to 6 weeks also. And then we're doing a lot of other stuff to help with the lung biology. So, you know, we hope to continue to contribute to that field. See, lungs, I feel like as I said, you know, it's a very fascinating organ, you know, and just being exposed to the outside air, there's just so much going on in the lungs. You know, it's very fascinating to us and our research program.
Well, we've set aside some additional funds for COVID research at the American Lung Association, so feel free to apply for any of your ideas. Now, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time and going through all the computer issues. I believe we're all done.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you again to Dr. Barat for his time and insight into a fascinating and monumental breakthrough in lung transplantation. His and his team's work have provided a foundation to build more promising care for patients severely afflicted with COVID-19. And thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning into the second episode of Lungcast. We're glad to have kicked off this new project with a couple of world-leading experts discussing their roles in this, the greatest public health crisis of our time. So why not another? Next month's guest, possibly the most trusted man in medicine right now, and he will be sharing his thoughts on the pandemic with us. Stay tuned. Until then, this is Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.